This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. In February of last year, 39,000 tons of coal ash spilled into the Dan River. Yesterday, the company responsible for that environmental disaster, Duke Energy, pleaded guilty to 9 misdemeanor counts of criminal negligence for those violations. As part of the negotiated deal, Duke Energy will pay $68 million in criminal fines and $34 million on environmental and conservation projects. The company also agreed to set aside $3.4 billion to ensure that it can move all that coal ash across the country into lined landfills. WUNC environment reporter Dave DeWitt's been following the story and is back with us now. Hello, Dave.
Hi, Frank.
Tell us about this plea agreement.
Well, it was a long time in coming. It started after the Dan River spill last year that the Department of Justice got involved in an investigation. They impaneled a grand jury. It was very secretive for the last year or so. We didn't know where the grand jury was meeting or what they were talking about. And then in February of this year, we heard Duke Energy said that they were preparing to enter into plea negotiations that might cost them somewhere in the neighborhood of $102 million, which seemed like a really specific number. And that's exactly what they did yesterday. It was the hearing in front of the judge. The plea agreement was accepted by him. A long laundry list of sentences based on these 9 misdemeanors.
All right. And what about this $102 million? Is this something Duke can pass on to customers?
No, legally they cannot pass it on to customers. $68 million of it are straight fines to the U.S. United States of America, Department of Justice. And then the rest of it is in compensation to various agencies that had to react to the spill, and also goes to some conservation efforts in North Carolina and Virginia.
All right. What did Duke Energy's attorneys say about the deal?
Well, it was interesting. During the sentencing phase, obviously they'd already reached all the numerical decisions and plans, and this is the way they're all going to go forward. But he wanted to make a case, Jim Cooney, he wanted to make a case that, look, Duke Energy made some errors here. They apologized profusely. They were negligent errors. It wasn't anything anybody set out to do. He kept saying and repeating, Duke is a changed company now. Duke is not the same company it was. Now, we asked him later what that meant exactly, and he said, look, Duke Energy is not the kind of company now that isn't going to listen to its own people. We're going to do what's best, but we're also going to have better communication in-house. He pointed to the fact that Duke Energy could have taken on a $5,000 study, a video camera of the pipe that burst a couple months beforehand. It chose not to do that, even though its own engineers told them they needed to. 3 other pipes also needed the same visual check. That pipe obviously burst and cost them $102 million.
And was that the negligence? Were there other accusations
There were many aspects of the Dan River negligence, but also in its investigation, the Department of Justice went and at 5 other locations around the state of North Carolina found enough criminal negligence going on to add charges there as well.
All right. And Duke Energy took a plea in federal court for violations of the Clean Water Act. But that doesn't mean the end of the legal proceedings, right?
It doesn't. Duke is keeping its attorneys very, very busy, not just in the federal courts, but there are at least 15 cases in state courts now brought by the state of North Carolina and various environmental groups. There's all kinds of cases being brought up. There could be other cases brought up in federal. There wouldn't be criminal cases. There are other issues having to do with how they move the coal ash and permitting laws and everything else. So Duke will be very busy in courtrooms across the state for a long time.
All right, a total of $102 million in fines. Let's put that in perspective for us, will you, in terms of total revenue for this company and adjusted profits?
Well, Duke has about $24 billion in revenue, sales, electricity sales, essentially, last year. And, you know, that revenue boils down to about $5 or $6 billion, give or take, on the year. Net revenues, net income, profit, I guess. So what you're talking about is really a small drop in the bucket. Now, on top of the $102 million fine, this finding, this settlement also requires Duke to set aside $3.4 billion to make sure that coal ash is moved in a legal manner and to lined landfills. When taken in with the $24 billion in annual revenue, though, that's still not a whole lot.
And what about that 3.4? Is there an opportunity cost or just setting that aside that could be passed on again to customers?
Yes, absolutely. The Coal Ash Management Commission, when it had its first meeting last fall, that was one of the first points made by some of the commissioners that, hey, this is something we're all going to have to pay for, this coal ash. So in terms of moving it and moving forward, it's likely that rate pay increases will help pay for that.
All right. Dave DeWitt, WUNC Environment Reporter. Thank you, Dave.
Thanks, Frank.
In other news, on the legislative front, over the last 4 years, the GOP-led General Assembly approved measures to allow gun owners to carry concealed weapons in city and county parks, to carry guns in bars and restaurants. This session, Republican House members are pushing a wide-ranging bill that would further relax gun control in North Carolina. But opponents of this controversial measure have stalled the bill's progress. Joining me now to talk about it is WUNC Capitol reporter Jorge Valencia. Hello, Jorge.
Hello, Frank.
What does the so-called Second Amendment Affirmation Act do?
Well, like you just said, there's a lot of elements that are in this bill. It actually started out as several separate bills, and lawmakers decided to put it all together into one major omnibus guns bill. And there are really two parts of it that have gotten the most attention. One would prohibit physicians from asking their patients in a form, in writing, whether or not they have a firearm at home. And then another one would repeal the requirement for people to get a permit from their local sheriff before they go and they buy a handgun.
All right. And tell us about this. Let's talk about the repeal of the permit. Tell us about those permits and how they're applied, and you know where the controversy is and why they'd like those. The House anyway would like them repealed.
Okay. So this is how it works. Somebody who wants to buy a handgun is required to go to their local sheriff and apply for a permit to go and buy that handgun. Now, a detective or somebody in the sheriff's office will run that person's name through a national database and will also check local court files that are only available locally. So some of the things that they're looking at, and this is actually at the discretion of the sheriff's office, each one does it differently, but some of the things that they're looking at are, for example, misdemeanor, a domestic violence offenses, issues pertaining to involuntary commitment to a mental facility, issues that really only they have access to and aren't available in this national database.
All right, so let's talk about some of the opposition. You talked to Paul Vallone, who's the president of Grassroots North Carolina. He favors this legislation. Tell us about that.
Well, what I posited to him in the conversation that we had is that the sheriffs actually oppose this legislation. Sheriffs across the state oppose it, because it takes away their discretion that they have in whether or not people should be issued handgun permits. And here's what he said about that.
We should consider how that discretion has been used. Basically, what it says is the sheriff can determine that you are not of, quote, good moral character, whatever that means. And whatever it means is whatever the sheriff wants it to mean. In the 1930s, it meant minorities couldn't buy guns.
All right, so that's one of some of the opposition they have. This could be – it's very discretionary. It's up to the sheriff. And it's not transparent. The sheriff doesn't have to tell the individual or anybody else. So is it on the public record that it has been denied and why?
Well, I'm not fully percent clear on what each sheriff in each of the 100 counties have to do. But I do know that if somebody is denied their permit from their sheriff's office, they have the ability to appeal it to the sheriff himself. In most cases, it's not the sheriff who's doing the application process. They can appeal it to the sheriff. I spoke to some sheriffs who said they've actually reversed the decision after individuals have contacted them. And if not, they can go to the court and they can actually appeal this to a judge. And the judge has the authority to reverse the sheriff's decision and force the sheriff to issue the person the permit.
All right. Now, you talked about this provision on a health form that asks whether or not you have a gun. Tell us about the provision and why that's so controversial.
Well, the way that this would make it so that you can't – a physician can't ask you in writing, in a form, whether you have a handgun at home. And so – and I went to my internal medicine physician this morning, and I asked to see a copy of the personal health summary that I gave them when I started seeing a doctor there. And these are some of the questions in this pages-long questionnaire. Do you need help walking? Do you need help at home? In the last year, have you been hit, pushed, kicked, or threatened by a partner? Are there guns in the house? Do you wear a seatbelt? Do you exercise regularly? So what physicians were explaining to me when I was doing research on this is that this is simply one of many questions that they ask to be able to get a sense of the person's safety at home and in their environment.
You spoke with a pediatrician at Chapel Hill, Dr. Tamara Coyne-Beasley, who's also a professor at UNC Medical School, right?
That's right.
Let's hear what she has to say.
If I knew someone was suicidal and I knew someone was homicidal, it would be very important to talk to the parent about removing that firearm from the home. And if not, if you're not willing to do that or don't desire to do that, recognizing that some people don't, we would really prefer the American Academy of Pediatrics that you unload that gun, that you lock up the gun, and you lock up the ammunition separately.
All right. And a national lobbying organization has actually made ad buys in the states. So we've drawn a lot of attention. Tell us about that.
That's right. Everytown USA, this was a nonprofit that was founded in 2014 by Boston Mayor Thomas Menino and former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who has been pretty outspoken against firearms. So here's
a bit of the ad.
The Second Amendment goes hand in hand with common sense gun laws. So why do some lawmakers in Raleigh want to repeal North Carolina's handgun background check system? North Carolina law enforcement knows that's a bad idea.
All right. A little bit unusual. This is a national organization weighing in on this issue.
It is unusual, especially at this early on in the lawmaking process. I mean, this hasn't even made it to the House floor yet, which is the first chamber that would hear it. So they're pushing pretty hard on it. I contacted them. I asked them how much money they're spending. They wouldn't say. All they said is that they were running it all this week in the Raleigh market, Greensboro market, and Charlotte market.
You said it's very early on, and yet it seems to have stalled. Has it? What are the likelihood? What are the prospects for this bill?
Well, right now it's moving slowly. Like I said, it started as separate bills. Then it was written into one big bill by the lead writer is Republican Representative Jacqueline Schaefer from Mecklenburg County, and it got its first hearing in a committee. And this type of bill needs to go through two committees. And now they postponed it for 3 weeks now. Mm-hmm. Every single week they postponed it. Mm-hmm. So we'll see where it goes.
Thank you very much. Jorge Valencia, Capital Reporter for WUNC. Just ahead, a new festival celebrates local writers and readers. You'll hear about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.